This one's got some fancy stuff in it. Ed and Lorraine Warren is featured in Time, Newsweek, The New York Times, and on the Mike Douglas and David Susskind shows. Ed Warren is one of only seven practicing demonologists and the only lay demonologist in North America. Lorraine Warren is a trance medium with strong powers of both clairvoyance and ESP. Since the 1940s, the Warrens of Spain have painstakingly investigated over 2,000 cases of the supernatural throughout North America, Europe, and Australia. They have taught courses on demonology and paranormalology and lectured to over 700 college audiences from coast to coast. Today, the Warrens are involved in their most publicized case yet, the murder trial of Arnie Johnson, the 19-year-old Brookfield, Connecticut youth who is pleading innocent on the grounds of demonic possession. Since that intro was written, as you know, from the devil in Connecticut, he was tried, convicted, and sentenced to years in prison that will take him beyond 2000 A.D. The first chapter is Beyond Amityville. I'm going to read this again. Outside Ed Warren's office in Fairfield County, an old chapel clock ticked away the passing moments with quiet mechanical precision. You can answer the phone. All else stood still. It was the middle of a cold, dark night in New England. Turn the lights out. Inside the office, a brass lamp lit the desk where Ed Warren, a pensive, gray-haired man of 50, sat working. Hundreds of books surrounded him, most bearing strange, arcane titles on the mysterious lore of demonology. Above the desk hung photographs of monks and grim-faced exorcists, standing with Ed Warren in abbey-like settings. For Ed, working in the still silence of night, it had been a wicked day, one that was not yet over. Just before the hour, the clock movement came alive in a series of clicks and relays, finally churning up three somber, resonating bongs. At the third stroke, Ed looked up, listened into the darkness, and then went back to writing. It was 3 o'clock in the morning, the true witching hour, the hour of the Antichrist. And now, unbeknownst to him, Ed Warren was on borrowed time. Only hours before, Ed and Lorraine Warren had returned to their home in Connecticut after having been called in to investigate claims of a haunted house on Long Island's South Shore, in a pleasant residential suburb of New York City. In December 1975, the house had been purchased by George and Kathleen Lutz, who moved into it around Christmas of that year with their three young children. A year before the Lutzes bought the house, the eldest son of the previous owner murdered the six sleeping members of his family at 3:15 in the morning of November 13, 1974, with a .35-caliber rifle. On January 15, 1976, the Lutzes fled the house, contending that they had been victimized by manifest supernatural forces. It was a case that later came to be known as the Amityville Horror. By the end of January 1976, turn this down just a little, Joe. By the end of January 1976, the press had become fully aware of the Lutz family's claim of a bizarre experience in the house. A little more. And promptly called experts into the case. Leave it there. I can move this closer. The experts brought in were Ed and Lorraine Warren. The Warrens were consulted because in professional circles they're considered to be perhaps this country's leading authorities on the subject of spirits and supernatural phenomena. Over the course of some three decades, Ed and Lorraine Warren have investigated over 3,000 paranormal and supernatural disturbances. While in his office writing his report on the Amityville case, Ed Warren himself comes under attack. You know the story. I read it to you. Ed Warren's office is located in a small cottage-sized building attached to the main house by a long enclosed passageway. As Ed sat working on preliminary details of the Amityville case that fateful February morning, the latch at the end of the passageway snapped open, followed by the percussive boom of the heavy wooden door. Footsteps then started toward the office. Ed leaned back in his chair, waiting for Lorraine to enter with a much-needed cup of coffee. "In here," Ed Warren called out. Long moments passed, however, and she did not appear. "Lorraine!" Ed called out again, but there was no reply. What he heard instead, building in the distance, was an eerie, howling wind. It was not the whistling of wind under the eaves, but rather the menacing roar of a distant cyclone. Goose flesh rose on his arms. "Lorraine," he asked forcefully, "are you there?" Still there was no response. As the ominous swirling sound built in power and intensity, Ed quickly thought back over the last few minutes. It then occurred to him he had heard only three footsteps in the passageway, not the continuous tread of a person walking. Something was wrong. Suddenly the desk lamp dimmed to the strength of a candle flame. Then abruptly, the temperature in the office plunged to that of a walk-in freezer. A rank, pungent smell of sulfur rose in the room. Suspicious of the unnatural clamor, Ed Warren opened a desk drawer and withdrew a vial of holy water and a large wooden crucifix. He then got up, walked a few steps out of his office into the anteroom, and as he did, there swirled out of the passageway a horrendous, conical whirlwind. Pointed at the bottom, broad at the top, the thing was blacker than the natural blackness of night, far larger than a man. And the swirling black mass moved into the dimly lit room and drifted slowly to Ed's left side and came to a halt some 10 feet away. As Ed watched, it appeared to grow even denser and blacker than it was before. Indeed, within the swirl, he could see that something was beginning to take shape. An entity was beginning to manifest in physical form. As a demonologist, Ed Warren knew he had to act quickly to take the initiative before this fearsome black mass transformed itself into something even more forbidding and dangerous. So holding the cross toward what was now rapidly changing into a macabre hooded specter, Ed Warren stepped forward. The moment he did, however, the entity moved defiantly toward him. Now, you know I've read this to you. And I've got a lot of other things that I've finished and some of them unfinished in this book. The thing I read from it tonight was not just to bait you. It was to tie it in, to begin to let you see the network connections that, to those that look, there is an abundance of information available of demonic activity. Now, we've gone, starting with these Catholic demonologists, we've gone to the other extreme, to the girl bitten with demons, the Pentecostal preacher in Manila, to the shaman, from the events in and around the Bermuda Triangle, to Merrill Unger, the Southern Baptist scholar on demonology, to the missionary of the late 1800s of the Conservative Church in China. Now I'm going to take one of the famous ones. If I'd started here, probably you'd have turned me off in the beginning. Let me read a little from the book to you. This is the event that Ed and Lorraine Warren were investigating when that horrible specter appeared at his cottage in the openings of the book, The Demonologist. I stared into the mirror. This is in the introduction. I stared into the mirror in sheer disbelief. That's not me. That can't be me, I screamed. I, Kathleen Lutz, am a young, blonde-haired housewife with pale, soft skin. But that's not what I saw in my reflection. I had turned into a disgusting-looking 90-year-old hag. My hair was white and scraggly, ugly creases and crow's feet scarred my face. I drooled all over my shriveled-up, dried skin. It was the work of horrible, evil spirits that plunged my family and me into chilling terror for 28 days. News on New York's Channel 5 announced it was doing a series on people who claim to have extrasensory powers. Now, this is the Amityville Horror, a true story by Jay Anson. Bantam book. Probably out of print. The program cut to reporter Steve Bauman investigating an allegedly haunted house in Amityville, Long Island. Bauman said that on November 13, 1974, a large colonial house at 112 Ocean Avenue had been the scene of a mass murder. 24-year-old Ronald DeFeo had taken a high-powered rifle and methodically shot to death his parents, two brothers, and two sisters. DeFeo had subsequently been sentenced to life imprisonment. 2 months ago, the report continued, the house was sold for $80,000 to a couple named George and Kathleen Lutz. The Lutzes had been aware of the killings, but not being superstitious, they had felt the house would be perfect for themselves and their three children. They moved in on December 23rd, just before Christmas. Shortly thereafter, Bauman said, they'd become aware that the place was inhabited by some psychic force and that they feared for their lives. They talked of feeling the presence of some energy inside, some unnatural evil that grew stronger each day they remained. I've been reading these for weeks. After a while, the gestalt ought to land or surface. Too much here to ignore all of it. 4 weeks after they moved in, the Lutzes abandoned the house, taking only a few changes of clothes. At present, time of this writing, they were staying with friends in an undisclosed location, but before they left, Channel 5 stated, their predicament had become known in the area. They had consulted the police and a local priest as well as a psychic research group. They reportedly told of strange voices seeming to come from within themselves. Of a power which actually lifted Mrs. Lutz off of her feet toward a closet behind which was a room not noted in any blueprints. Reporter Steve Bauman had heard of their claims, and after doing some background research on the house, he discovered that tragedy had struck nearly every family inhabiting the place, as well as an earlier house built on the same site. The Channel 5 announcer went on to say that William Weber, the attorney representing Ronald DeFoe or DeFeo, had commissioned studies hoping to prove that some force influenced the behavior of anyone living at 112 Ocean Avenue. Weber claimed this force may be of natural origin and felt it might be the evidence he needed to win his client a new trial. On camera, Weber said he was aware that certain houses could be built or constructed in a certain manner so as to create some sort of electrical currents through some rooms based on the physical structure of the house. Again, the scientists said they're investigating that to rule that out. And after they rule out all reasonable or scientific explanation, then it's going to be referred over to another group at Duke University who will delve into the psychic aspects of the case. All of that quoting from the Channel 5 news report. The report concluded by saying that the Catholic Church was also involved. Channel 5 stated that two emissaries from the Vatican had arrived in Amityville in December and were reported to have told the Lutzes to leave their home immediately. Now the Church's Council of Miracles is studying the case, and its report is that indeed 112 Ocean Avenue is possessed of some spirits beyond current human knowledge. 2 weeks after the telecast, George and Kathy Lutz held a press conference in Attorney William Weber's office. Take some bass out of this mic, out of this sound up there, Joe, will you? The DeFeo lawyer had met the couple 3 weeks before through mutual friends. George Lutz stated to reporters that he would not spend another night in the house. But he was not planning to sell 112 Ocean Avenue just then. He was also awaiting the results of some scientific tests to be conducted by parapsychologists and other sensitive professional researchers of occult phenomena. Called in would be Ed and Lorraine Warren. At that point in time, the Lutzes cut off all communication with the media, feeling that too much was being overstated and exaggerated, and it's only now that their whole story is being told. I mean, all that to scratch a little itch on my eye. I could knock my face off with that. I tried to put my finger through these little short glasses. Come over here, Mike, so you can get the picture of these headlines. Chapter 1. December 18, 1975. What it says. George and Kathy Lutz moved into 112 Ocean Avenue on December 18th. 28 days later, they fled in terror. George Lee Lutz, 28, of Deer Park, Long Island, had a pretty good idea of land and home values. The owner of a land surveying company, William H. Perry, Inc., he proudly let everyone know that the business was a third-generation operation. His grandfather's, his father's, and now his. Between July and November, he and his wife, Kathleen, 30, had looked at over 50 homes on the island's south shore before deciding to investigate Amityville. In the course of their search, George called the Conklin Realty office in Massapequa Park and spoke to broker Edith Evans. She said she had a new house she wanted to show him. There's a floor plan of the house and the property, so you can study what the demon's going to do later on. The house had been on the market for almost a year. It was not in the paper, but was fully described in Edith Evans' agency listing. Exclusive Amityville area. Six-bedroom Dutch colonial, spacious living room, formal dining room, enclosed porch, 3.5 baths, finished basement, 2-car garage, heated swimming pool, and large boathouse. Asking $80,000. And half of Los Angeles jumped in a car to go buy houses in Amityville. They were surprised at the price, too. The realtor told them it was the place where the DeFeo tragedy took place. They assumed that's what made it so underpriced. They bought it. During the remainder of November and the early weeks of December, the Lutzes spent their evenings laying out plans for minor modifications. They packed and moved out of their old house in one day, and they arrived, dog-tired, assigned rooms to the kids, and with the side door of the van finally open as they arrived, the three children leaped from the van, made right for their respective toys that they had packed, and began a parade of unprofessional movers in and out of the house. Took time to maneuver furniture up the fairly narrow stairwell leading to the second and third floors, and they had requested Father Manusco, or Father Mancuso, rather, their priest, to come and bless the house. As they got the basics out of the van and into the house with the help of five of George's husky friends. It was well after 1:30 p.m. Now, Father Frank Mancuso is not only a cleric. He handles clients and family counseling in his diocese. He knew this family. Kathy, he had counseled. He knew her problems trying to raise three kids. He was pleased that they were going to move into a nice house. And George, the new husband, would provide a home and be father to the children. It was past 1:30 when he arrived to bless the house. The Lutz's driveway was so cluttered he had to park his old Ford on the street. He removed his clerical articles from the car, put on his stole, took the holy water, entered the house to begin his ritual of blessing. When he flicked the first holy water and uttered the words that accompanied the gesture, Father Mancuso heard a masculine voice say with terrible clarity, "Get out!" He looked up in shock and whirled about, his eyes widened in astonishment. The command had come from directly behind him, but he was alone in the room. Who or whatever had spoken was nowhere to be seen. Get out. This is an old story. You don't want me to hear this thing. You're not interested in this one, are you? I mean, they've already ruined this with a movie. You don't want me to continue. Am I boring you?
No,
sir. It's hard enough to work with this dumb mic without knowing that I'm boring you. You don't want me to go on with this. Lee over there says, "Go on." And Enoch so prophesied. The book of Enoch. Now people say, I got to sneeze. There are advantages to this movable mic. Now my sneezes always come in pairs. Where's the other one? Rerun. Now you say, well, you know, Enoch, that's hypocritical. Which is just a half a step from hypocritical. Well, it's apocryphal. For a mystery. It's the opposite of apocryphal. The only problem with those who want to put this book down is that they got problems with Jude too. Because Jude, in the New Testament, let's go read him. Jude. Too cold in here, Mike. I'm freezing. Lord have mercy. Page 293, if you got a Bible like mine. Jude's kind of hard to find if you aren't used to going to the Bible. Which is why Craig had to ask. You start like this in the back, Book of Revelation. You go back to the first chapter of the Book of Revelation. See, that's pretty easy to find because you got lots of chapters in the Book of Revelation. You go back to the first chapter of Book of Revelation, and you look to the left, and right there is Jude. I mean, didn't we make that easy? Jude, chapter 14. I just hate to be bullied by these King James people. just because there's no chapter, just verses. They got 25 verses. That's sort of slighting Jude. I mean, how do we know he didn't think that he wrote 25 chapters? And I really get just tired of being pushed around by old King James and his crowd. Jude chapter 14, which also happens to be the 14th verse. And Enoch also, the seventh from Adam, prophesied of these, saying, behold. I'm hung up on something else, though. I'm hung up on the these. Enoch also, the seventh from Adam, prophesied of these. Well, what's the these? Well, you got to go back. You got Jude. I just might as well start at the front. Chapter 1, Jude, the servant of Jesus Christ and brother of James. To them that are sanctified. Well, if you aren't sanctified, turn it off. It has nothing to say to you. All you unsanctified ones, turn the knob now or go to the restroom or do something because you shouldn't hear this. Jude, the servant of Jesus Christ and the brother of James, to them that are sanctified. Now, there's just something about that word that turns all my spiritual vibrators on. Sanctified by God the Father. Now, that means only perfectly righteous people can listen to this. Bull spit. I love to walk the edge of the line. Sammy said, especially around that. I ain't an unconscious preacher. I hear everything. You see, if it had to do with behavior and perfection, the word would be righteousness. Sanctification is a derivative of the word hagios. It had nothing to do with perfection in behavior. Solely to do with commitment. It was not unique to Christianity. It's the same word from which we get saint. It was used of the saints of Aphrodite. Had all kinds of saints to Aphrodite. You can walk the ruins of Corinth today and look up at the Acropolis on the hill dedicated to Aphrodite and the temple in Corinth, made the Mustang Ranch look like a cheap shop. You know, there's a pretty good illustration there about faith. I mean, at the Mustang Ranch, they get a few bucks and hope to earn enough to do something different someday, I hope. You say, why are you talking about the Mustang Ranch? Well, you know, TV. I mean, I'm up in Reno, that's one reason. But I'm 46,000 miles away. So there's not much danger to me, you know, that trip up there to the satellite and back does not carry too much risk to it. But Los Angeles TV has been spending an awful lot of time pointing out the Mustang Ranch is for sale. Now, there's an investment for the Moonies. Well, now, let's continue. I try to teach that faith has an eternal perspective. The same act down here is taken note of in eternity, and its primary accomplishment is an eternal event. That's why you can die not having obtained the promise down here, because the fading act connects you to heaven and achieves the promise of eternal salvation. If you're sick, your act of fading and God's promise to heal may not get you out of the wheelchair. It may also get you out, but it may not necessarily do it, and you may die not having obtained the promise. But from the moment you started fading, the divine connection was established, and the eternal benefits begin to accrue because of faith. Now, it may appear to be a crass and gross illustration, but a lot of people who do not understand the problems Paul was dealing with in the Corinthian city in his message to women in that Corinthian church was that it was the seat of the worship of Aphrodite, and in the temple, the girls who served there as prostitutes were saints to Aphrodite. And to carry the analogy, and by its grossness, it may make the point of faith, which I'm forever trying to make. They, unlike the Mustang Ranch, who only, I hope, seek temporal return, they felt they were serving the divine goddess Aphrodite in the same transaction. Indeed, the roots of the worship came out of Persia, where in some of the religious contexts, the bride-to-be had to go and serve a night in this religious temple before she went home with her husband. They put divine connotations on it. The relevance to Jude is that the word saint had no holy meaning to it. They were sanctified to Aphrodite. They were saints of Aphrodite. Because to saint something, you give it to the use of. It's a liturgical word. All a saint is someone who said to God in faith, I'll take your promise. That as I confess, really proclaim, profess, the promise that God takes me as I am, and as I act in faith, he puts my sins on Christ, he puts me in Christ, seated in heavenly places, and he puts his Spirit in me to carry forward the saving process. I, therefore, as Ephesians 2 says, have become the habitation of God through the Spirit as an act totally of God's in response to my faith. But my faith had to carry with it the commitment principle. I'm going to be the habitation of God through His Spirit if God keeps His Word. And it's that willing to become God's habitation, willingness to become, that makes you a saint. It's a committing act. As you fade, you are accepting the fact God's going to place His Spirit in you. That's what makes you a saint. Now the rest of you can listen. You don't have to be perfect to be a saint. God gave some apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, and teachers, and I'm one of those, for the perfecting of the saints. And the word perfect does not make you a perfect performer, but bring you to the completion of God's purpose in you, in His calling you to be a saint, preserved in Jesus Christ. You see, most people with the... I never intend to get on that. I'm going to talk on demons. I can't read the Bible without getting stopped with something. Preserved in Jesus Christ. Oh, I thought that I'm preserved by my performance. You're a real bunch of peach preserves, all right. God accepts the sanctifying commitment, and He puts His Spirit in us. We are now separated unto Him from ourselves because we've dared to open the door to God's abiding presence. It's going to change you. That's risky. It's going to change you. We're preserved in Jesus Christ. The minute I sanctify myself, I'm still imperfect. The perfect one comes, but I'm still imperfect. But my act of faith not only brought the sanctifying presence, I am taken by God and placed in Christ, seated in heavenly places and preserved in Him and called. Yeah, called. Mercy unto you, and peace and love be multiplied. Now, why didn't He say, dump on you? Beloved, when I gave all diligence to write unto you of the common salvation, common in the sense of that which we share together as the saving experience, it was needful for me to write unto you and exhort you that ye should earnestly contend for the standards and the traditions. Keep the traditions pure. That ye should earnestly contend for the faith that made these great assemblies of God what they are today. Exhort you that ye should earnestly contend for the great Baptist doctrine and experience that started with old John himself. Earnestly contend for the faith which was once delivered unto the saints. For there are certain men crept in unawares, who were before of old ordained to this condemnation. They were predestined to do it that way. Ungodly men, turning the grace of our God into lasciviousness and denying the only Lord God and our Lord Jesus Christ. Now I've got people say, that's what you're doing. They don't even know what lasciviousness is. They don't know what it is, and they don't know how to spell the word, and they don't know what it means. It was a doctrine that Jude and Paul both had to deal with. Since God pours out His grace to forgive sin, we need to get more of God's grace in this world, so let's go out and send some more so we can force some more grace to be poured out so grace might abound. I will therefore put you in remembrance, though you once knew this, how that the Lord, having saved the people out of the land of Egypt, afterward destroyed them that believe not. Same message as Hebrews. They put God on trial. They wouldn't hang in there with their faith. And the angels, now now I'm down to demonology, and the angels which kept not their first estate. The margin says principality. But left their own habitation. He hath reserved in everlasting chains under darkness, under the judgment of the great day. Well, now, that means all the angels that fell, along with Lucifer, when he rebelled against God. Well, if that's true, how come some of them are running loose? Because this says he hath reserved in everlasting chains under darkness unto the judgment of the great day. How about those that he's going to turn loose out of the bottomless pit who serve with Abaddon or Apollyon in the book of Revelation? It's either or. Either Revelation is speaking of the judgment of the great day, or there are some of them not in everlasting chains under darkness under the judgment of the great day. Isn't it? Because some of these get out. Let's go to the book of Revelation. Hard to see through this red mic. 9th chapter, page 301. If you got a Bible like mine, you can get one for, how much is it? $44? Get it here. I guess page 300. Chapter 9. 5th angel sounded, saw a star fall from heaven unto the earth, and to him was given the key of the bottomless pit. He opened the bottomless pit, and there arose a smoke out of the pit as the smoke of a great furnace. And the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit, and there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth, and unto them was given power as the scorpions of the earth have power. They had a king over them, verse 11 says, which is the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in the Hebrew tongue is Abaddon, but in the Greek tongue hath his name Apollyon, which means a destroyer. Calls him an angel. See, angel just means messenger. But it's a supernatural person, obviously on Satan's side, a destroyer called the angel of the bottomless pit. Now let's go back to Jude. Jude said, the angels which kept not their first estate. See, first estate in the King James suggests that's the first position they had. Just they kept not their principality. You see, the King James people felt what most people feel, that these represented the angels cast down the first time. Kept not their principality, but left their own habitation. He hath reserved in everlasting chains under darkness unto the judgment of the great day. Revelation chapter 9 is not the judgment of the great day. There's still much to come. So there is an alternative. There are some angels kept in everlasting chains under darkness under the judgment of the great day, and they're not going to get out. Whence come the demons that asked Jesus in the New Testament, are you come to send us to the abyss before our time? They were loose. And if all demons are fallen angels, how come some of them are running loose without everlasting chains? Now, how come the devil didn't get everlasting chains? Even as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities about them in like manner giving themselves over to fornication and going after strange flesh are set forth for an example suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. Why did you draw that analogy? Going after strange flesh. because these are angels who true had rebelled against God, and as Jesus said, I saw Satan cast down with his hosts. They were given a domain. They were given a habitation. They were given a principality. And some of you may wonder why, if they did it before the flood, they haven't been doing it since the flood. And you're saying, what? I'll get back to Enoch. Just follow me. The problem with most people who study the Bible, they don't connect. They go at it piecemeal. I teach to get a gestalt of the whole thing. Go to Genesis 6. Came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth and daughters were born unto them. Now that's still happening, isn't it? That the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. Well, are women no longer fair? Huh? Are you all ugly now, ladies? There's one lady said we're still fair. One woman of courage in here. I tell you what, all I got to do is leave town and you all go dead. When I'm here and you make us go 7 days a week, 4 and 8 and 6 hours a night, you really get vinegar coming out of you. Give you a few days off and you turn into duds. That's what it is. I'm simply saying the sons of God still exist. These angelic, supernatural creatures still exist. Women are still fair. They took them wives of all which they chose. The Lord said, my spirit shall not always strive with man. And that he also is flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. And man's got 120 years grace before God destroys the earth through a flood, and all of them save a handful. There were giants in the earth in those days when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, and they became mighty men, literally Nephilims, which were of old men of renown. Now, the point I'm asking, if, as is forced by any sound scriptural exegesis, I mean, there are three alternates that are usually given with the scholars. Sons of Seth married the daughters of Cain. Nonsense. And I'll read Merle Unger's arguments on that. They're probably the best. That didn't necessitate giants. The other that's offered by some Jewish scholars, the elders and rulers married the common people. That isn't what it says. Sons of God's never referred to anybody except these angelic beings. These, you say, well, but the New Testament. We become sons of God through the implant of the Spirit of God, which makes us sons of God. But the Old Testament reference and the word used is always of angelic beings. What this sixth chapter of Genesis would have us believe is that angelic beings cohabitated with women on the earth and produced offspring. Now, many traditional interpreters of Jude have only two steps, or one step, really. Angels that were good joined with Lucifer to rebel against God, bang, angels that are bad. If that's the case, they were in heaven, and then they're in everlasting chains. Then who in the hell are these creatures running around as demons and doing all this? And how come Satan had access to the throne of God and to the counsels of God to gain permission to persecute Job? And who are these evil princes that Michael and Gabriel have to deal with when they're trying to bring prayer requests to Daniel? And I've already said, who are these demons running around the New Testament? What Jude is talking about is something that happened to the fallen angels after the rebellion, when they were still left with a principality, still left with a domain, but they fooled around. With the women on the earth, and the punishment was, those who did are in everlasting chains under darkness, under the judgment of the great day. Now, there's only two conclusions. Either all of those who did are the only ones who could, and they're in everlasting chains and not loose and posing such a threat anymore. Or what was done to them was sufficiently convincing that they ain't running around, those that are left, doing it anymore. Do you follow what I'm saying? I don't care whether you believe this or not. I'm not sure that this is ever taught in any Bible school. First place, you just don't talk about, unless you can figure out a way for a stork to bring a baby from a demon and a woman, or a fallen angel and a woman, you don't talk about it in Bible school. Because all good Bible school kids know that God makes babies and puts them in a little diaper and a stork brings them there. I want you to see something, because we must get to come to grips with the source of a vast body of demons. The Bible does not indicate, oh, I know, there's no marrying or giving in marriage in heaven. There are people that tell you there's only one kind of angel, male angels. Well, how do you know? You ever taken a shower with one? We're in a realm that we just got some little glimpses of. We don't know that much about it. Now, I've been reading the scary stories to try to get us to understand that we don't just have to blindly take the Bible as it's taught traditionally. But as always, when you start paying attention to some of the mysteries that occur in life and in history, you're going to be driven back to God's Word to find the answer to the mystery. Now, rightly interpreted, the angels which kept not their principality, but left their own habitation, those that had a place, he hath reserved in everlasting chains under darkness, under the judgment of the great day.